This episode is brought to you by Hill's Pet Nutrition. Every shelter pet deserves a second chance, and you're making it possible for thousands of them every day. Because when you feed your pet Hill's, you help feed a shelter pet, which helps make them healthy, happy, and more adoptable, changing their life forever. So they can change yours. Over 14 million shelter pets fed and adopted. Science did that. Visit hillspet.com/podcast to learn more.
AJWS.org. From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. The Last Samurai shot to the top of the box office rankings last weekend, fueled by superstar Tom Cruise, elaborate costumes, and pitched battles between the last warriors of a feudal society and the American Gatling guns of a modernizing Japan. It's just the kind of Hollywood historical drama that captures imaginations and inspires copycats and sequels. The bloody allure of fighting to the death for honor against the cold face of modernity is hard to shake. It sits in the magnetism of a supposedly simpler past, when humans were bound by obligation instead of law. And it's not such a dusty memory in much of the world today. Tonight on Point, The Last Samurai and the planet's unfinished battle between feudal values and modernity. But first, a third or more of the new U.S.-organized Iraqi Army's first 700-man battalion has quit, reportedly because of low wages and threats to their lives. Nick Childs is Pentagon correspondent for the BBC. I asked him what he could tell us about the resignations.
Well, Tom, as we understand it, it's between 200 and 300 people out of the 1st Battalion of the Iraqi Army that has been going through its training processes. I don't think there's any doubt that this is a considerable embarrassment for the Pentagon, because it's been trumpeting the whole issue of bringing Iraqis into the security forces.
So that's 200 to 300 out of maybe 700. That's a large percentage of this 1st Battalion.
Yeah, it's a large percentage of this particular battalion. But what Pentagon officials are pointing out here is that actually, in terms of the overall numbers of Iraqi security forces, it's a very small number, because they have something like 160,000 people now in the various forces that they're putting together, the police, the border guards, the civil defense forces. So I think that's the kind of context they're putting it. Of course, they are going to look into why this has happened, because it is a large number within this particular unit. The indications are that it's possibly as much to do with anything with pay as possibly other concerns. And it's something that, if that is the case, then they'll have to look at very seriously, because apart from anything else and apart from the general trumpeting of the whole issue of the security forces, there was a lot of profile given to this particular unit, the army units. It paraded in front of Paul Bremer when it was being trained and all that sort of thing.
And this is the army that's supposed to be 40,000 strong by next October, under a year from now.
Certainly, in terms of the ultimate strength, that is the case. Yes, it's 40,000. But when the precise timing is, I think, is a little bit unclear. But again, one of the things that people here at the Pentagon are saying is that while it would be wrong to say this is not a top priority, but in terms of the threats that are being faced in Iraq now, the external threat, the threat of some conventional army attacking Iraq, is perhaps the least priority.
But the army is also the one that's supposed to guard border checkposts and so on, where we've been told foreign fighters have been coming in. Nick, point to the various reasons that these men may have left this budding new Iraqi army. We see it's not a fiasco, yet it's not a good sign. What are the elements? First on pay, what are they paid?
They're paid in the region of $50 to $60 for an ordinary soldier, which is a good bit more than the Iraqi army was getting before Saddam Hussein fell.
And that's per month?
Yes, per month. But that's not necessarily a good criteria, because one of the concerns, I think, and one of the things that they're looking at is whether, compared to what other people are getting in other parts of the security forces, it may not be enough.
What other factors came into play here, Nick? Were there threats against these soldiers because they were in the new Iraqi army?
Well, that's clearly one of the issues that has been of concern, is the kind of pressures that throughout the whole security forces they're facing. And of course, people have actually been killed. Let's not forget that in terms of the security forces in general, it's not just a case of people receiving death threats, but they've actually lost something like 100 people already in terms of those people who are in the whole security forces. So there's no doubt that there are risks involved. Again, what the Pentagon here are saying is that that issue has not raised a problem with those other forces.
So we're not talking about something on a very large scale, and yet it's a significant portion of the new Iraqi army. As I understand, this was the first battalion, maybe 700 strong, and up to 300 now resigned. There's only one more battalion so far that's up and in training, or just has just begun to be trained. Is that right, Nick?
That's right, yes. The reason it's taking a lot longer in terms of the army as compared to, say, the separate border guards, who are the ones who are doing the border policing at the moment. You know, there are thousands of those actually doing the border patrolling issues right now, is two things. One is that those are the priorities at the moment. It's the internal security and it's the infrastructure support and the infrastructure protection and the policing that are the priorities now. And you've seen huge numbers coming in the last few weeks. But the other issue is that the army does take more training. It takes more training to operate as a soldier with all the equipment that you're likely to need than it is to be a facilities protection officer standing on a corner providing protection for a building in a city. And that may well be related to one of the reasons why the troops feel that they're perhaps not being rewarded as much as they should be.
And they, unlike police, would be living in barracks and not at home. Nick Childs, it sounds like not a calamity here yet, but certainly an embarrassment and a factor to keep an eye on as the U.S. tries to rush toward big numbers of Iraqi security forces over the year ahead. Thanks very much for joining us today.
Okay.
Nick Childs is Pentagon correspondent for the BBC. He spoke with us earlier from Alexandria, Virginia. The past is not dead, said William Faulkner. It's not even past. Not in any case if Hollywood has its mythologizing way. With the current Tom Cruise blockbuster, The Last Samurai, the way of the big screen samurai is to value death over dishonor and loyalty over law. But there's a living germ of truth here. Moviegoers feel it, and it may echo in the rationale of the suicide bomber against the encroachment of the modernizing West. Tonight on Point, the enduring struggle between feudal values and modernity. Did you see The Last Samurai? Who did you cheer for? The feudal guys? The regiments with the Gatling guns? Are feudal values and modernity still locked in a kind of battle today? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now in the studio is Andrew Gordon, professor of history and director of the Reischauer Institute of Japanese Studies at Harvard University and author of A Modern History of Japan, from Tokugawa Times to the present. Good evening and welcome, Andrew Gordon.
Thank you very much. Pleasure to be here.
Thanks so much for being with us. So have you, professor, seen the movie? And did you come out retching that this was completely ahistorical, or was there some history in this big Hollywood treatment?
I came out, I did have the pleasure of seeing the movie a few weeks ago, and we invited the director to come to campus. And
you had Edward Zwick at campus.
He came and did a screening for the students in some courses that are looking at the history of the samurai and the way the samurai are constructed. So it was almost like a made-for-classroom movie. It was great. I came out of it a little bit worried and astonished at how it had turned history into myth. Some of my historian colleagues thought that was fine. We should just bracket the history and go
right,
with the myth.
Right.
And so we've been having some vigorous debates about it.
Well, let's talk about that for a moment, because some of our listeners will have seen the movie, others will have not. Just to convey a little bit of the story, let me convey some and then get your kind of historical response to it, or the view of an historian. This is set in the 19th century, in the 1870s, I think.
That's right, 1870s.
The Meiji Emperor is pushing Japan, and those around him, the businessmen around him, are pushing Japan to modernize. The black ships of Commodore Perry have come into the harbor in Tokyo, kind of shocked old Japan into a recognition that there's a big modernizing and dangerous world out there. They need to modernize to catch up. He brings over
An American Civil War hero who also happened in the movie story to have fought the American Indians with Custer and to help whip his new kind of Western-style army into shape to fight against a kind of rump army of samurai who are holding out against this modernization, who are still embracing the old kind of feudal ways. And this Tom Cruise played a hero, Civil War hero, ends up, this is no secret, going over to the samurai, being enamored of their ways, of their discipline, of their honor code, that he ends up siding with them, and on it goes from there. How much history, how much myth in the basic story?
Well, I think there's a kernel of a historical story here. The samurai in the 1870s really were on the defensive from modernizers. But one thing that's portrayed in the movie that's very misleading is that the modernizers were also samurai. They were all former samurai. They weren't sort of businessmen born out of the merchant class. And so this was a war within the samurai class that in some ways had been going on for quite a long time. And in fact, swords were taken away, hairstyles were changed.
That's putting it mildly. I mean, they wore a kind of a, what, the top of the samurai head was traditionally shaved.
Right,
the
right.
sides were long. They had a top knot. This was, this is portrayed in the movie as being cut off in the streets as a way of signifying a break with that past, the sword-bearing past. Historically accurate?
Well, the Meiji Emperor started to wear his hair Western style and sent the word out that people should conform, men anyway, not women. Women were told to keep the old ways, actually. And for the most part, it didn't require that kind of coercive moment, but there may well have been some. And men, the samurai, were also told to switch to, and encouraged to switch to Western dress. So in a sense, there is a real historical transformation here. But what I think the director did was turn that moment of transformation into a kind of morality play, which may be why it resonates in America, that ultimately took far off from the historical reality.
Are you saying that even though these were all essentially all samurai, was there not a tension between the old feudal ways and the new modernizing ways? Surely there must have been. This was very long-standing tradition in Japan. Did everybody just roll over and say, fine, we're going to put on three-piece suits?
No, there were rebellions. There were rebellions, and so the movie is telling a story of a rebellion like some rebellions in some ways. But what's missing is any idea, I think, that the samurai had anything at stake besides honor.
Let's get a flavor of this history the way the last samurai portrays it. Here is the samurai leader Katsumoto telling the American that the emperor's troops will come and he'll have to kill himself from shame since the way of the samurai is over.
It is the end. For 900 years my ancestors have protected our people. Now I have failed them.
So you will take your own life. Shame. Shame for a life of service, discipline, compassion.
The way of the samurai is not necessary anymore.
Necessary? What could be more necessary?
The samurai leader played there by the really terrific Ken Watanabe. Andrew Gordon, how did the tension between the feudal past and the new modern play out in Japan? How long did it take to kind of iron out that tension, the rebellions, the cultural tension that you allude to?
Well, the tensions about the notion that something is being lost was actually in many ways underway since the 1600s. So one thing that you don't get from a movie that set it at that moment is the fact that even going back to the late 1600s, the samurai as the lone warrior with a personal tie to a lord was vanishing. And you know, the most famous tale of Japanese theater, this tale of the 47 Ronin, dates from that time, and many listeners might know it. And you've got these 47 masterless samurai out to avenge their dishonored lord with a personal vendetta. And that's sort of the essence of the old feudal way.
But that is still an immensely popular story in Japan.
Right.
Does that not mean, I mean, of course, cultural remnants linger long after the facts have moved. Did the feudal impulse not live on? Didn't we even see it in Japan's early militarism to some extent in the 20th century?
Well, I think the feudal impulse was, in a sense, created at that moment. The code of the Bushido didn't really exist in that form until the samurai became vanishing or vanished. And so in that sense, this reverence for the samurai is a product of the modernizing process.
Ooh, that is really interesting. The kind of alchemy when the modernizing comes brings a kind of, a new veneration of the samurai way. Andrew Gordon, stand by. We're talking tonight about The Last Samurai and the unfinished battle between feudal values and modernity. Did you see the movie? Who did you cheer for? Did you find yourself rooting for the feudal guys? Why? Do feudal values still walk the earth? Where? Why? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about The Last Samurai, the new Tom Cruise movie, and something that's not on the screen, maybe an unfinished battle between feudal values and modernity, right off the screen, right beyond Japan. What do you think? Do feudal values still walk the earth? Where and why? Are feudal values and modernity the real combatants in the Middle East, maybe in the War on Terror? Is there a link between the suicide bomber and the samurai readiness to die in the name of honor, or are these creatures of mythology? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We've been joined in the studio tonight by Andrew Gordon, director of the Reischauer Institute of Japanese Studies at Harvard University. We're joined now from New York City by Fuad Ajami. He's professor of history and director of Middle East Studies at Johns Hopkins University. He's author of The Dream Palace of the Arabs. Good evening and welcome back to On Point, Fuad Ajami.
Thank you, Tom.
Thanks so much for being with us. Fuad, as you listen to this story, hear these tales revived, think about the clash of cultures in time, of feudal culture, of modern culture, and particularly listening to Andrew Gordon's last observation that the in Japan, the veneration of feudal values really blossomed when they were confronted by the modern.
Right.
Where does that lead your mind in terms of the Middle East today? Are we wrong to reach out and grope for some parallel here? Is there something to be learned? Is there still a feudal value abroad in the Middle East that's in contest with modernity?
Well, I think as I listen to your exquisite talk with Andrew Gordon, much of the Muslim world and much of the world of the Arabs in particular came into focus. I think of someone like Muhammad Atta, who flew into the North Tower at 8:48 a.m. on September 11, 2001, this lead hijacker from Egypt, mm-hmm. and I think his primitive code of honor, if you will. We know that this is a man who was worried about his ancient land, Egypt, becoming a Mac Egypt, as he called it, as in McDonald's, that it has been violated and modernized and disfigured and distorted. Mm-hmm. I think also about Muhammad Atta, that he did his thesis on Aleppo, the ancient city, and he felt this modern world pushing into his world. And I think there is a bit of the jihadist code of conduct, if you will, though criminal and grotesque, has something of it of the scream against the modern world. But again, what's interesting is that the modern world, these jihadists themselves were exceedingly modern in a perverse, cruel way.
That is?
Well, they no longer could live in the old traditional world as we know it. They were post-traditional men. They'd made their way to Hamburg. I mean, I think of one of the death pilots, one of the Muslim kamikazes, if you will, to bridge mm-hmm. the cultural gap here. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. His name is Ziad Jarrah. He came from my own city of Beirut. He was a highly modern young man. He was said to be a party animal. He was said to be quite modern. He went to one of the elite schools in the city of Beirut. So it is this disfigured union, if you will, between something modern and something old, and it's never resolved, and the tension is always there. And in a way, it runs through the minds of men in some way.
Fuad Ajami, let me put a thesis to you. I've heard this from Richard Landis. He's a professor of medieval history at Boston University. And I'm sorry he's not with us himself to articulate it tonight, and I probably won't get it exactly right. But I've heard him say When the modern world looks at the Middle East and sees it in its own image, it misunderstands that there's a kind of feudal set of values going on here. It goes back to the kind of a kind of rule or be ruled, an honor shame society that can't see or accept a win-win solution. The kind of, as he describes it, that came out of the Enlightenment in Europe in the 17th, 18th century, not part of this world. Is that too literal? Is there really a feudal culture of that current vitality there?
Well, I don't know if it's that. I mean, I don't know if it's that simple. I do make this very, very simple-minded, I will say, since it's mine, I can describe it, a simple-minded distinction between guilt cultures, which are the modern cultures of the West, the post-Freudian cultures, if you will, and shame cultures, which are, in a way, they live by a very different kind of a code of honor. But see, I think the dilemma in the Muslim world is there betwixt and between. For example, we know that of the 19 death pilots who came our way on September 11, 15 came from Saudi Arabia. They're not quite exactly children of the desert, of the old Saudi world, but they're not masters and at peace with the modern world. They're really between, betwixt and between. They're on the seam, really. And I think we think of them in many ways as nowhere men, because they can't go back to that old world. In a way, it's a bit like that old samurai. They can't retrieve the past, but they can't journey forward either.
Andrew Gordon, you describe Japanese culture on that seam as being the point at which this sort of veneration of a feudal code really came to the fore. I think no one could sit in the audience watching this film, in which you're clearly intended to sympathize almost entirely with the old feudal samurai against this faceless, dehumanizing, kind of anonymous Gatling gun bearing ranks of modern troops. I mean, you're essentially being instructed to go with the feudal. Is that a tension that Japan had to work out? How did Japan work through that kind of? How did it work off the seam, forward from the seam, as Fawad Ajami describes it, between the two?
Well, the modernists won decisively on the ground. Japan became capitalist, industrial, and imperialist power by the 1890s and into the early 20th century, and built up a formidable empire, formidable business world by the 19-teens and 20s and 30s, as everybody knows. But as that was happening, and the more it happened, and this is true, though, not just in Japan. I think it's true in America as much. As you become more and more modern, you become more and more worried about what you're losing. And so there was a deepening maybe or an intensifying or anyway a repeated concern with that. And so the hero of the rebellion that this movie is notionally based on, the Satsuma Rebellion, this man named Saigo, he becomes venerated as a noble failure, as a noble failed hero.
Right.
Much later, after the fact, and still today, that's how he's often portrayed. Although,
in history, in Japan, not in the movie.
In Japan, among the Japanese readers of historical fiction,
but the noble loser of the feudal cause, the honor cause.
But the winners are also, they are not portrayed in purely those negative terms. There's a lot of pride in Japan in those modernizers. Looking back after 150 years, saying, you know, the resistors had a kind of spirit that we sympathize with, but the modernizers were right. That's what we had to do. And we all live with the benefits of the world they built in material terms. And so there's a lot of support and almost nostalgia, too, for the people on the other side of that battle shown in the movie.
And you say not only in Japan, but even in your own country, the United States, you see a kind of echo of that.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of ambivalence that we have about a loss of virtue as we become more modern, and corruption and greed. I mean, the sort of criticism of things like Enron and these type of scandals, I see playing out in ways that have some resonance. And maybe that's why people will like the movie, because they identify those type of worries.
They want to find something that's not just cut and dry, something that's not just modern, and something that's not... somehow, why does modernity bring a notion of corruption with it? Let's listen to just a little bit more from the movie. Here, the Tom Cruise figure, again, with the samurai leader Katsumoto, they're creating a battle plan to fight the emperor's troop and troops, and the samurai questions the role of that destiny will play in their lives.
There was once a battle at a place called Thermopylae. 300 brave Greeks held off a Persian army of 1 million men. A million, you understand this number?
I understand this number.
For 2 days, the Greeks made them pay so dearly, the Persian army lost all taste for battle and were defeated soon after.
What do you have in mind?
Take away the advantage of their guns. We're overconfident we use that. Lure them close. Close enough for a sword.
You believe a man can change his destiny?
I think a man does what he can until his destiny is revealed.
In The Last Samurai, of course, the destiny doesn't go so well for the samurai, but we do see, we're left with the image, Andrew Gordon, you've seen this, of the modern troops bowing down in awe and honor at the sacrifice of the samurai to the normal way on the battlefield in their kind of, with their Gatling guns and new uniforms and all the rest, still in awe of that old way. I want to welcome another voice into our conversation. Fred Paxton is joining us from New London, Connecticut. He's Dean of International Studies at Connecticut College. He's author of Christianizing Death, the Creation of a Ritual Process in Early Medieval Europe. Good evening and welcome, Fred Paxton.
Hello.
Fred Paxton, help us think through this kind of ongoing tension between or dance between feudal values and modernity. I don't know if you've seen The Last Samurai, but I heard people walking out remarking on how they were surprised where their sentiments ended up in this movie, not with the nation of laws, but with the nation of honor. Do you see a tension still abroad in the world today around that?
I think so. And what's really striking about this conversation is that from my perspective as a European medievalist, this tension between shame culture and guilt culture, as Professor Ajami put it, is something that medievalists talk about in the 11th and 12th century in European history.
The tension already being there.
Already being there, that there was a shift from shame culture to guilt culture with the rising power of the Christian Church and dogmatic theology in the 11th and 12th century, and that people at the time felt that they were losing this sense of honor. And
what are the implications of that for those of us who may not understand the distinction? When you move from shame culture to guilt culture, what does that suggest? What does it imply? And internalizing instead of dueling or something?
Well, partly one way to look at it is to think of it as in terms of face-to-face society versus a society in which people are anonymous or alienated. The move from personal bonds that control people's behavior to abstract laws that control people's behavior.
Okay.
And that notion of modernity being defined by the abstract, by the rule of law, by mechanistic and rationalistic forces which lead to a sense of order, but also a sense of unhumanness, right?
It's set off against the modern ennui.
Yeah, exactly. Or what Max Weber called anomie, the sense of
anomie.
Yeah, sort of being out of sync with one's humanity. And so people look back to the past and say, "Oh, it used to be better at a former time." And so there are classicists who talk about a shift in the Roman Empire in exactly these same categories. So I often wonder whether this isn't a constant tension in human history and human value and human thought.
That we just dress up in the costume garb of a certain period, a medieval period or a samurai era.
Yeah, I mean, in European history, the first time people used the word modern, they actually used the Latin word moderni, is in the 12th century. and they set themselves off against an earlier time, both with a sense of optimism and progress and change, but also with a sense that something is being lost.
There's a lot of callers who want to join us. I want to turn to them. George is calling from Brookline, Massachusetts. Hi, George. You're on the air.
Thanks. I haven't seen Last Samurai, and my knowledge of Japan is limited to Akira Kurosawa movies about the samurai.
Well, you'll recognize Kurosawa in this film by Edward Zwick.
However, this discussion reminds me, in carrying forward by a few centuries, the comments that, Professor Paxton just made?
Yes.
If you go into the late Middle Ages, I think of, forget his first name, I think it was Jan Heisinger, and he wrote a classic, I believe it was called Decline of the Middle Ages, I'm not mistaken. It was a long time since I've read it. However, there was this kind of cult of knight errantry that developed in Europe at the time when the knights had no longer any function, partly because they had to be hoisted on cranes onto their horses.
So heavily armored.
Because the metal was so heavy, and they were already being outgunned by the new gunpowder, which had been introduced in the 16th and the 17th, and certainly was being used in the 17th century. So I'm not sure that from a historical perspective, the Japanese in the 19th century weren't going through this very same process.
Well, the samurai were kind of outmoded already.
Middle Ages.
Mm-hmm. George, it's a great observation. Thank you for the call, Andrew Gordon. Let me put it to you. You're kind of suggesting this earlier, that the height of the samurai's real function had been long before 1870.
That's right. They were really no longer warriors on a day-to-day or even a month-to-month and year-to-year basis for the most part, except for a few who were doing police functions after, say, the 1630s or 40s. So they had become civilians, and they were wondering what that meant. Their swords were pawned in many cases, mm-hmm. and their military skills were really weak. And that's why this vendetta was such a wake-up call. It made people think, my goodness, these guys are crazy because they don't understand that we're now a nation of laws.
This kind of last-minute vendetta against
right.
the modernizing emperor.
Right. Well, or the vendetta of the 47 masterless samurai.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yes.
And then again, the rebellion likewise. It evoked this sense of, these guys are outmoded and what they're doing is wrong, but they're also doing something that in a sense, we can sympathize with.
Right. But Fawad Ajami, you must hear echoes you recognize very well in that.
Well, in many ways, of course, when you think of what Osama bin Laden and Ayman Zawahiri and his types, what they've done, I mean, they have basically sold this vast mass of atomized young people in the Muslim world. Mm-hmm. They've sold them this image of a past that could not be retrieved. I mean, even the costumes that they have used. And part of the attraction of Afghanistan as a place from which all this was waged was that this was a setting that echoed and looked like the setting, what these people take to be the setting of Islam in 7th century Arabia.
It looks untouched. The setting,
exactly.
The scenery is still
exactly.
there.
And the clothes as well. I mean, there is a kind of a fakery to it because you give these people this irretrievable past as they themselves and the entire world of Islam as it's being plugged into the world economy and plugged into world culture, as you're losing your own children to Britney Spears and so on, you still want to retrieve this very sacred past that you disfigure for your own purposes.
And there's a romanticism woven about it, even as violent as it may be.
Definitely. I mean, the whole idea is, of course, even what these people tell, what the Islamists tell the world of the Arabs and the world of the Muslims, is they tell them that there is a shame about the way they are living today, at the sufferance of the West, mm-hmm. and that there is a nobility in some return.
Fawad Ajami, Andrew Gordon, Fred Paxton, please stand by. We're talking tonight about The Last Samurai and the unfinished battle between feudal values and modernity. Are feudal values and modernity the real combatants in the Middle East? Is Al-Qaeda the dark side of feudal honor? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about The Last Samurai, the movie, and the unfinished battle between feudal values and modernity. Did you see Tom Cruise dressed up like a samurai? did you find yourself rooting for the feudal guys in The Last Samurai? Why? Why do feudal values still resonate in the darkened theaters of a 21st century world and beyond? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm joined tonight. With me in the studio is Andrew Gordon, director of the Reischauer Institute of Japanese Studies at Harvard University and author of A Modern History of Japan from Tokugawa Times to the Present. From New York City by Fawad Ajami, professor of history and director of the Middle East Studies program at Johns Hopkins University. He's author of The Dream Palace of the Arabs. And from New London, Connecticut by Fred Paxton, dean of international studies at Connecticut College and author of Christianizing Death, The Creation of a Ritual Process in Early Medieval Europe. You can join the conversation as well. Lisa's calling right now from Watertown, Massachusetts. Hi, Lisa, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
You know, I think it's no mistake that this is a Hollywood movie. There are plenty of neo-feudalist impulses right here at home without looking at Japan or the Middle East.
Name them for us, Lisa.
Well, look at the debate about getting rid of the social safety net and how that's couched. We say that a lot of the reasons that people give for getting rid of things like welfare is that it's corrupting somehow,
mm-hmm.
and that it makes people less honorable.
Mm-hmm.
But if we get rid of that social safety net, one of the possible outcomes is that you end up on the ground with a permanent aristocratic upper class and a very large peasantry.
So
what
do you see?
Like?
Do you see a little samurai
like?
Strut in the walk of George Bush?
Sure. And, you know, what's we prefer things like Clint Eastwood or John Wayne style leaders that have you're with me or against me style foreign policies. We don't have to look very far abroad to look for neo-feudalism. We have it right here at home.
So you're saying you don't have to dress it up. I mean, look beyond Republican, Democrat or conservative, liberal. You're ready to put maybe modern and neo-feudal on it. Lisa, thanks for your call. Andrew Gordon, how about it? In that world of the samurai, what did it mean? I mean, in the movie, the samurai village looks like everybody's a nobleman and everyone's sort of equally engaged in disciplined training with the sword. In reality, was there a hierarchy? Were there serfs in feudal Japan or the equivalent thereof?
Well, first, I just want to say I thought that was a great call, and I absolutely agree. The movie speaks out to issues in America,
mm-hmm.
I think, in those sorts of ways. The village in the movie is a kind of idyllic paradise that you really don't recognize if you look at probably many societies. There's no hierarchy there to speak of. There's one lord, and everybody else is sort of, it's a flat organization, right.
And,
right?
And they're all noble.
And they're all pretty healthy and
yeah.
strong and educated equally.
And no one's doing scut work that
right,
I can
nobody's
see.
Doing grubby work. And also, the samurai love the peasants and have this sense of commitment to them. But in fact, they could be pretty ruthless and exploitative. And they lived off the earnings that were taken from the peasants, off their taxes. And
mm-hmm.
what really was most at stake, I think, in the rebellions was the loss of their income. Because the government took away, the samurai had hereditary salaries, basically.
Yes.
They were basically pensioners or welfare kings.
Around to hypothetically fight if needed.
Right, exactly. So they were kind of a standing army that was getting salaries so that they'd stay ready if needed. And the new government said, this is crazy. This is so expensive. We can't pay 6% of our population and 80% of them aren't doing much. And so they cut off their incomes, but it wouldn't have been nearly as exciting a movie if it was about a bunch of people who had just lost their salaries
clamoring
and they were
at
going
the bureaucrats
to war.
Gate.
So.
Fred Paxton, how about Lisa's readiness to see a neo-feudalism in her own American society as a medievalist? Does that make any sense to you, or are we several cycles down the political road from that by now?
Well, again, for medievalists, for European medievalists, feudalism has kind of technical meanings that might not actually be appropriate here, but I think Professor Gordon's remarks are really quite to the point that in feudal society in medieval Europe, the aristocracy was, you know, lived off the exploitation of the peasants who they were lords over. And when modern standing armies started to become the rule, and the caller who called a little earlier made a very good point that chivalry and the dream of knighthood mm-hmm. is something that is really an invention of the late Middle Ages when it's really over. Mm-hmm. And so again, there is a kind of repetitiveness in the phenomena that we're discussing tonight that is really historically really fascinating. Whether or not it's happening in today, I think it's more the kind of lone hero and the man who lives by a code of honor in a world in which there's so much gray and there's so much uncertainty about what constitutes honor that makes the appeal of this pre-modern representation so strong.
Mm. And the power of those old symbols, even if they're very old, that old way is still culturally very resonant. It's something we can all recognize. Dina's calling from Boston. Hi, Dina. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah, sure.
My question has to do with the irretrievable past mm-hmm. idea.
Mm-hmm.
There's such a huge well of sentimentalism in our culture for this idea of this more noble, more direct society. And let's say someone was really moved to withdraw from such a modern society. Are there feasible options in our first world society to go to?
Well, I mean, you go to the movies for one, see The Last Samurai, or to look back to where Edward Zwick surely took his title from Fenimore Cooper's The Last of the Mohicans. But Fred Paxton, how about it? Time travel apart, you're a medievalist. Perhaps it's crossed your mind. Where do you go when you get just absolutely thrumming tired of the modern way? Is there a, you know, feudal style escape for you?
No. No, there really isn't. And again, my sense is, first century Romans were looking back to a lost pre-imperial Roman past and idealizing that. And so, honestly, sometimes I think that it may be biographical and it may be generational, that it's part of being a human being as you go through the course of your life to think within these terms and to think back, you know, that the past and your childhood sometimes get conflated and that simplicity and that purity that you first experienced gets projected back into the past. And I think people, if anything, I think you're right. They go to the movies, they read historical fiction, they imagine a world that isn't as complicated and difficult as the one that stares them in the face.
Fawad Ajami, we started out here with the movie in Japan. We took a swing through the Middle East, and our callers are bringing this kind of feudal lens or interpretation right to American culture. When you hear that, how does it sound to you? Do you sit in the United States and say, yes, I see echoes of this thing, shame culture right here in the United States as well, or manipulation of historical symbols, even pre-modern symbols in the U.S. as well? Is it on a par with what you've described in the Middle East?
Well, that's a good question, Tom. I think, anyway, modernity and nostalgia are twins. They come together. And the more we journey into the modern world, the more nostalgia rears its head. But I'll tell you one thing about why I think the way you phrase the question is the right way and why it haunts our world. About 1.2 billion people in the world, I'll walk them quickly for you, from Indonesia in the east to Morocco in the west, are Muslims. And the problem there is that they've been banished from one world, but they haven't been given another one. Mm. So these feudal ideas, if you will, this old ideas, this nostalgia for, you know, the Muslims talk about the righteous ancestors, the people who succeeded the Prophet in the 7th century Arabia.
Mm-hmm.
What happens is that as you take people into a modern world they can't master, nostalgia is always there. And the distortion of nostalgia by people who are skilled at manipulating it, that's what really haunts our world, and that's what's really a very big story in the Islamic world.
Andrew Gordon, we've just got a minute left. Take us back to what we can learn from Japan, which clearly has modernized very successfully. What was the secret of them disentangling themselves from a kind of disabling romance with this past?
That's a good question. It's still the costs of becoming modern are still a sore point in Japanese culture, but I think you're right to say it's not a disabling point. I think the trauma of the Second World War was very important.
Are you saying it took an atom bomb or simply the suffering of the entire thing?
Well, with or without that bomb, I think there was enough trauma to go around. And 3 million or so people died out of 70 million in the population.
And that's a lot.
That's a lot.
Let's hope it doesn't take that much trauma globally. Andrew Gordon, thanks so much for being with us tonight.
Thank you.
And Fred Paxton in New London, Connecticut, thanks for being aboard.
You're welcome.
And Fawad Ajami in New York City, thank you very much for joining
us. Thank you, Tom.
Listeners, you can continue this conversation online at onpointradio.org. Click on forums. In a moment, one man builds a cruise missile in his garage. This is On Point. The federal government goes to great lengths to make sure that weapons like cruise missiles are not brought into the United States by terrorists. But what if terrorists were able to build such weapons themselves in a suburban garage? That's exactly what New Zealand engineer Bruce Simpson says he has been able to do. With less than $5,000 and a couple of months of his time, Simpson says he has built a functional cruise missile using materials that were not very difficult to obtain. He hasn't tested the missile yet, and he won't be able to do so until he settles a tax dispute with the New Zealand government, but Simpson is confident that his guided missile will work. In this radio diary, New Zealander Bruce Simpson explains why he decided to patch together a high-tech missile in his garage.
It was in response to what I perceived to be a vulnerability in terms of perhaps U.S. Homeland Defense, and I'd already written an article about a year before in which I basically described the risk, and that article produced quite a raft of response from people around the world and also people within the U.S. military who confirmed my suspicions that indeed there was a problem here. So being aware of the 9/11 situation where the airlines and the government both knew that there was a significant risk that terrorists may hijack airliners and use them as weapons of mass destruction, but nobody actually did anything about that risk until it was actually demonstrated. What I decided to do was to prove the point that you could build a cruise missile using off-the-shelf components and readily available information. In building this missile, I managed to get virtually every component I needed, either locally through regular stores or off the internet. I used eBay, where I purchased the GPS system and some of the servo actuators needed to control the craft in flight. I was quite surprised, actually, even though I knew it would be easy, I was surprised just how easy it was. For example, I had to import some of the equipment, the GPS and some of the control systems, had to import those from the USA to New Zealand. Those imports were not flagged at the border. There was no questions asked. There weren't even any import duties levied on them. They just were delivered straight to my house. So throughout the entire project, it flew completely under the radar of authorities who may have been, you know, vigilant for signs of terrorism. If I hadn't actually publicised the project, nobody would have known that I had this missile sitting in my garage. Earlier this year, I received contact from a company that claimed to be an Iranian aerospace and missile company. They offered me the sum of $100,000 in return for access to my research and development. I figured initially that, goodness me, you know, this obviously I'm not allowed to export this type of technology to Iran, but I'll just check with the government. So I contacted New Zealand's Trade and Industry, which is the government department responsible for issuing export permits and things like that. And I was completely floored when they told me that there was no problem with exporting this technology to Iran, even though it had military application. If a terrorist can build a cruise missile in a suburban garage, transport it on the back of a pickup truck without being detected, launch it within, say, 50 to 80 miles of a target, then that target is pretty much indefensible. The only weapon that a country has against this kind of attack is vigilance. Basically, what I've told people is if you have a new neighbour that has recently moved in, you hear them making a lot of noise in their garage, they're carrying sheets of metal in and doing welding and all sorts of things, instead of just sort of ignoring that and thinking, well, perhaps they're building some lawn furniture, pop your head over, go and introduce yourself and ask what they're doing in the garage. And that way it becomes much harder for someone to perhaps build their own weapon of mass destruction, so to speak, in a garage. As long as the terrorists know that the job of doing this is now an awful lot harder, there's much less chance that they'll actually do it.
Bruce Simpson lives in Tokoroa, New Zealand. He says his cruise missile has been moved to a location unknown even to him while he deals with bankruptcy. He hopes to test the missile sometime next year. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.